kinds of credible threats made against her life.
The most surprising aspect of these attacks were how they actually threatened my safety, my real life safety. The danger that I felt was being placed on me and my family, I think that was the most shocking, as well as how they've escalated, how it feels, how relentless they can be. I don't think there's been a few days where there hasn't been an attack since the defamation in the Daily Mail in February. I never realized it would be so intense like this, so real, quite dangerous, to the point where a few days ago I didn't get a death threat, and I thought, wow, I didn't get a death threat today. And then yesterday someone commented and said, very soon, Rahmi, with a timer running out, sleep with one eye open. And when they first started happening, I thought, that's really strange. Like, I've never had that. But because of how intense they've gotten, and when I had to call the police, they've changed. The way that I see them has changed. It feels like a real threat. Yeah, somebody. This one was probably the one of the worst ones, because I literally had to, like, I saw it on my phone, and I had to do that in real life. And I don't know what I had just said. I think it was a post on X, and it was, my posts are always either mourning the Palestinian martyrs, or sharing news and, like, commentating on it, or saying that I'm sort of against the war crimes and the system that is being propagated, Zionism, Jewish supremacy. And somebody commented and said, I'm going to come to your house and slit your throat. And, like, you know when you just, like, you feel like your breath has been taken away a little bit. That's there. I don't know. I just don't understand why. I was thinking, so many things were going through my mind. I was like, well, this surely can't be a real person. Is this a bot? Why would a bot write that? Like, who's programmed the bot to write that? If it's a real person, then why would you want to slit my throat? Like, I think even, like, in a normal, like, setting, even when, if people write, you know, really outlandish comments, or if people write outlandish comments, or if they say something that's a little bit, like, you think, yeah, you see sometimes people will post something that I think, oh, that's a dangerous thing to say, like, that's not, or maybe, oh, that's a little bit, that's illegal, that's a threat that you've made. Like, I don't expect that people would go and threaten that person.
That means we don't need it to be translated when the woman who had nine of her children...
Dr. Ladwan does not want pity and for the focus to be on her personal fight. The focus of her activism has always been for the innocents being subjected to a genocide at the hands of Israel and its backers, and for the care of her own patients.
I feel so ashamed to pity myself or get emotional, because there's just, you know, there's Palestinians we know who, like, have lost, like, all their family members. There's, like, Palestinian
babies in hospitals that are the only survivors of their families, and they don't know it because they're babies, but so it just it feels wrong to pity ourselves or, you know, feel like, oh, we're going through so much. But I just think, oh, I don't know, you know, I don't expect to be treated in any way better than anybody else. See, that's the whole point that we're campaigning for, is that we're all equal human beings. But it feels like, I don't know, like, I feel like I have a duty to my community and my patients and the Palestinian people, especially that the bombs that are shredding them to pieces are, you know, using my taxes. It's absolutely out of my control. But I feel like I have a duty to be doing what I'm doing. And some people say, oh, well, you don't have a duty to say glory to the breaking of the 17-year siege. And I feel like I do, because not enough people say it. Not enough people center the right narrative.
The new tribunal adjourned the case, meaning this saga continues to hang over Dr. Ladwan. The General Medical Council, the GMC, denies that it's brazenly renewing legal action until it and lobby groups like the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism get the result they want. With no new evidence of wrongdoing presented, regulators seem content to simply drag the process out to maximize harm to Dr. Ladwan and her career.
Now you see what that did, and that made an independent ruling, an independent panel buckle. That is perversion of justice, of the rule of law in Britain. It may start at a hearing for a doctor, which I don't think we should take lightly, because we're here to save lives, to treat the British public. But that means that sets a really outrageous precedent, where we might be seeing court rulings being negotiated again.
Despite the threats and the intimidation, this proud pro-Palestinian knows her purpose.
I try not to show my vulnerable side online for two main reasons. Exactly. The one is that what I said, you know, Palestinians are the focus. Yes, everybody's struggle is valid, but for me, it is just my everything I've gone through in terms of the emotional stuff. I am alive, right? I'll talk about it. I want to share the people's story and voice who are not guaranteed to be here in an hour or tomorrow. I was just so upset about the Holocaust. And they put me in danger, like real danger. Then that's when I knew. I was really crying at work, you know. I was just upset, and they went so far as to, you know, me having to call the police. I realized then that when they see weakness, when they see emotion, they actually just escalate. They come harder at you, which is so demonic.
IRIB English Radio. If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. We are about to actually continue our discussion regarding some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei with you. We have been doing that actually for a couple of episodes in the past, and we'd like to do so in this episode too. Let me begin our episode with this question. If a government contractor were to give a monetary gift to the government official by whom he is hired, or to the government supervisor who is responsible for assessing and overseeing his work, would this be permissible?
Well, it's very much clear that a gift is given to, let's say, to a government official to appease him, okay, to draw his attention. This is nothing but a kind of corruption. It is not permissible for the recipient, who is supposedly a government official, to use that gift. Whatever the name you call it, it could be a kind of gift, or in other words, it could be a kind of bribe, okay? But anyhow, the term bribe is less likely to be used in this context, so it's a gift that must not be received by the government official. It is the government's official to do his job without receiving any gifts. So, according to His Eminence Karana Ayatollah Khamenei, may Allah grant him long life, all such practices that can actually potentially lead to the spread of the kind of corruption are to be avoided under all circumstances and at all costs.
Mm-hmm, I see. Well, I'm going to ask you something regarding tayammum, Sheikh.
Yeah.
Is it necessary to wipe our forehead by the palms of the hand, or is it valid actually if you do so by the fingers? And what's the prayer said after doing tayammum, wiping the forehead by the hand?
Right. In tayammum, of course, wiping should be done by the inner surface of the hands, from the wrists to the tip of the fingers. So, first of all, you wipe the forehead, and it's both sides, from the hairline to the to including the eyebrows, by both hands. Make sure that the palms, the inner surface of the hands, are used to cover those areas: the forehead, the eyebrows, and the two parts of the two sides of the forehead. So then, you move the palm of your left hand on the back of the right hand, and the palm of your right hand on the back of your left hand. And also, according to His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, the obligatory precaution is to hit your hands on the ground and move the palm of your left hand on the back of the right hand,
mm-hmm.
and the palm of your right hand on the back of your left hand. The point is to hit the ground, the floor, the dust. Okay.
Yes.
Otherwise, it's not a fatwa to hit the ground, right?
Yes.
With your hands on the ground, It is just an obligatory ihtiyat or precaution, okay?
And should the surface be dusty or no? Any piece of a stone would suffice it.
If
you want to do tayammum instead of wudu.
Yeah, of course, it should be... If it's dusty, it's okay.
Uh-huh.
It's quite good to,
yes.
To have dust.
If it is not dusty?
If it's not dusty, and there's nothing, no dust to be found. There is a piece of stone. There are pebbles, small
right?
sands.
Yes.
Of course, you can do tayammum on the sands, okay? But it's much preferable to find dust anywhere.
What about the stone which you find, for example, in the chapels of the hospital?
I don't think, you know, because there's there are stones, or you find them, they are...
A piece of clay, but it's actually the, what you may call it, a dry piece of clay.
Dry piece of... Do you mean bricks?
Like bricks, for example.
Well, I'm not sure if the religious authorities allow doing tayammum on the...
What about the stones?
Bricks.
Piece of
the
stone?
Stones are allowed doing tayammum on stones.
But there's no dust on the stones.
Of course, but it's not necessary to collect dust
uh-huh.
to put... otherwise, there's dust everywhere. You
yes.
can put it on your face. That would
suffice.
Work. But
yeah,
but
thank you very
the
much.
Philosophy is not to collect dust. That's why, because when you
uh-huh.
when you hit your hands with your palms on the floor, you can shake your hands to remove off the dust.
Right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Sawid. Let's actually take a break, and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio.
Followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/EM. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jahad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still speaking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javid, somebody asked us that he's a marketeer, and sometimes he has to deceive his customers or force them to buy their products, for example. Is that allowed, actually, to do so?
Deception is not allowed. It is not a tactic to be permissible. These religious authorities and Islamic law, generally speaking, does not allow any deception, any kind of playing a trick, or any kind of fraudulent activities.
Mm-hmm.
It's necessary to be honest and to just tell the truth to the customer. If there is any defect, if there is any kind of problem with the items which is being sold to the
mm-hmm.
customer,
yes,
that defect must be told, must be the buyer must be informed about it. Otherwise, the buyer has the right to rescind
mm-hmm.
or to cancel the transaction.
Yes.
So to be a marketeer is no problem. It is okay to just to be a vendor or
mm-hmm.
a seller to a businessman. That's fine.
Yes.
But it's not allowed under any circumstances to deceive one's customer or to force them to buy something when they do not want to buy it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Who would pay the expenses of caring for parents, her daughters, or sons if they have enough money or income? Who should look after them?
Well, it depends on the existing situation of the mother or father. if they have enough income, no one is to pay for their expenses. They can manage their lives by themselves. They can run. They have their own sources of income. But if they are desperate, if they are in need of help, it is the duty of the children, male or female. It makes no difference to pay without any difference, among them. Whoever can afford to help his or her parents must do so within his or her ability, as far as it lies within him or her, right? As far as he or she can afford to help. So it's not, it's wrong to expect the male children to support their parents financially, and then the female children are absolved and they are relieved of the obligation. No. Every child has to play his or her own duty and role to support their parents financially. They should do it in a way that the parent is not bothered or disrespected or kind of obliged, right?
Yes.
It's necessary to maintain the parents' dignity and self-esteem.
I see. Yeah. Thank you very much. Let's take another break and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Stay tuned.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javed, what's the rule, what's the Sharia law regarding selling muddy vegetables to customers? Or let's say to pour water on the vegetables, you know, to keep them fresh and then sell them like that, because actually it, you know, overweighs their original value and an original weight, right?
Right. Well, in itself, in by itself, of course, there's no problem in selling muddy vegetables or pouring water on the vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is exposed to the buyer, and
yes,
it's quite, the buyer can see the vegetable that is wet and that it's muddy.
Yes.
There is mud clinging to the vegetable. So, of course, he has the right to buy it or not to buy it, okay? The transaction is permissible. The transaction is valid according to His Eminence Quran Ayatollah Khamenei.
Mm-hmm. I see. Is it permissible to sell vegetables in bunches or cleaned?
Right. It is. There is no problem. It is. It's quite okay, permissible to sell it in whatever way one chooses to sell. It's normal to do so, of course, to sell vegetables in bunches.
Yes.
And also to clean the mud from the vegetables and to sell it. Okay.
Yes.
So when you clean the mud and remove the mud, the price goes, the price increases, and people are more likely to buy it.
I see. Well, thank you very much, Javed. Thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to your own program. That is the Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, whereby we try to deal with normally, some of the jurisprudential laws, whether they are related to a topic or not, like of general and miscellaneous nature. And in this episode, we try to actually deal with some of them for you, based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei, of course. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
لا إله إلا هو الغفار الجبار. tired of dreaming of this world. Won't you come along and dream with me? It's picture perfect in my mind. Oh, how I wish it would be real. Oh, real. No one living on the streets or digging for a bite to eat. And pain and hunger are nothing, nothing but a memory. Let's dream to make it real. Dream your biggest dream. If we dream enough together, fathers for the sons to be left all alone crying. Oh, oh, crying. Elders and children are all careful lovingly. No one falling through the cracks of government bureaucracy. Let's dream to make it.
Joining me this week on the Moscow Report is Leonid Savin. He is the chief analyst of the Sargat Institute, headed by the famed Russian philosopher Alexander Dugin. He's one of Russia's top experts on the multipolar world and spends most of his time traveling the world, Venezuela, Iran, and next week he's off to Cuba. Mr. Savin, thank you for joining me. First of all, has the multipolar world already arrived, and how do you see it developing?
It depends from what point of view we'll see on multipolarity. You know, there's different theories, different scholars introduced this term, for example, in the 60s, and American scholars like Deutsch, Singer, proposed one vision of multipolarity based mostly on positivist science. And of course, the pole means connected with physical geography. And in some sense, it's connected with bipolarity order. I mean, balance of Soviet Union and the United States at this time. There is another point of view proposed, for example, by John Mersheimer, the different types of multipolarity, unbalanced multipolarity or balanced multipolarity. This point of view of nuclear multipolarity, that nuclear powers already kind of poles. Pakistan, Israel, in this sense, also actors of multipolarity. But for my opinion, it's better to rethink about what is pole. For example, I proposed in my book, Ordo Pluriversaris, point of view that Martin Heidegger told about pole. It's originally Greek word and also connected with polis, with politeia, and Heidegger told that it is kind of center of being of people. And his view, it Greek people, but we also can speak about Iranian people, about Chinese people, about Russian people, and from this point of view, there's many poles.
Because it seems that the Western model, if you like, based around NATO, is a kind of empire that's run from Washington. Of Europe increasingly becoming vassals of Washington. But is the idea of multipolarity, the idea that there is no center to this empire? You look at Russia, China, Iran, they have a kind of friendship, but they all have their own sovereign interests. Is that the difference between the multipolar world and the Western idea?
Yes, of course, and it depends on what view. Because Chinese people not see the world future God like we Russians or Iranian people look on all these phenomena. And there's a kind of Western type of point of view to need to control the world, that only one Western civilization exists. And from our point of view, there are many civilizations, Chinese civilization, Iranian civilization, Turkish civilization, etc. And of course, there is kind of interest of to provide security for our sphere of influence. And if we speak about multipolarity, I see this contemporary moment like emerging multipolarity.
There's historically been a great deal of mistrust between Russia and Iran. How do you see their relationship now? Do you think it's strong enough to resist the Western desires to damage or destroy them both?
Yes, we have some historical conflicts between Persia and Russian Empire, but at the time we have very good relation during the same period. For example, Russian troops assisted to suppress coup in Tigran in November 1916, when Turkish and German again tried to reorganize and to catch the power in Persia. And then it was time of Soviet Union, and of course relation was not good because of Islamic revolutions. But then we developed very good economical, political ties on high level, and for last years we see that also kind of public diplomacy development between countries. Of course, we need more cooperate with Iranian people, and because we have the same vision on the global world to assist oppressed people, the same vision on Palestine, for example, the same vision on our common enemies like United States and collective West.
Because I'm speaking to some Russian people, and there's an idea that Russia doesn't really understand Iran, or Iranian culture or history. You've been to Iran recently, I think a couple of years ago. How did you find the country, and what do you think could be done to create more trust between the two countries?
For Russians, ordinary people, Iran is an amazing country. It's a very ancient civilization, and very interesting to see different aspects, because it's not only one ethnic group. It's like Russia consists of many ethnic groups and many historical, cultural customs, tradition, etc. But for my opinion, for some last years, Kerbzadegi is coming back. Idea of proposed Jalil Ali Ahmad that the Iranian people are poisoned by the West, and now it seems a little bit pro-Western trends inside of Iran, and a kind of MTV television, kind of Western dress of woman, man, etc. And I think it's not good. But from another point of view, I think technical modernization, that's good for developing countries, despite of sanctions provided by the West against Iran.
Do you see Iran as strong at the moment? Were you impressed about in their war with Israel? Who won the war against Israel?
Of course, I'm an external person who can analyze only by objective news coming from different sources. From my point, yes, and because Israel also stopped aggressions, and it seems that Iran have enough power to resist. And last news from different sources have kind of confirmation that Iran prepares for any type of new aggressions and would like to be more strongest than before.
And has the United States, do you think, accepted the multipolar world under their new president, Donald Trump? Is Trump adjusting their policy back towards their own hemisphere? Should Venezuela be worried?
America First is not about multipolarity. It's very clear. Even during time of Barack Obama, they proposed the idea of leadership about multilateralism. It's kind of pseudo-multipolarity. And the United States, of course, seems like a leader of global war. And Donald Trump would like to reorganize foreign policy, first of all, back to South America. It's in Latin America, experts and analysts told that it's kind of doctrine Monroe number two. It's what Trump doing now. I mean, pressure on Venezuela, pressure on Panama, other countries. But he also interested in Asia, because the real economical rise in Asia, in China, in Japan, in Korea, for many years ago. So he very afraid the rise of China, and of course it's threat number one for the United States and for Trump. So he tried to balance, and how it's possible, I don't know, because really economical system in the United States now is very weak. He tried to bring more of assault back to United States. Why he pressure on European Union, this idea of new tariffs, also pressure on Japan and other partners.
Do you think he's doing a good job, or do you think he's understanding that the world has changed? One journalist said to me in Asia that Trump understands the changing realities of the world, but everything he's doing is still damaging their interests.
I think nobody wants hot conflicts and new wars, but everyone understands that time of United States is gone. So they would like to rebalance and try to find more opportunities. For example, Saudi Arabia, they organized a pact with Pakistan, defense pact. Another country is interested to more cooperations with BRICS club, joined to Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and to reorganize contacts with neighbor countries like Turkey do with Iraq, for example, and ideas, new corridors and new transport routes. So many actors who think about future, they understand that type of United States is gone, like main world power.
And is Europe too slow to respond to the changing realities of the world? It seems Europe is still stuck believing the world hasn't changed when it has. Are they too slow to recognize it?
The problem of Europe is Brussels bureaucracy. I mean European Union institutions, because they are real very slow and they depend on United States. Every country separately can do a great job, for example, like Hungary. United States not provided sanctions against Hungary to buy Russian oil and gas, for example. And some countries also balanced. But in general, European Union is very bad project. It's mostly dying. And ordinary people understand that very well in the end of Europe. So it's mostly problem of Brussels bureaucracy.
And is it in Europe's interest to have good relations with Russia, and why has that not happened?
In 19th century, Russian philosopher Nicholas Danilevsky told about root of the fears of Europeans on Russia. He told very simple, just look on the map, you will see that Europe is just a small western peninsula of continent, and there is huge land mass of Russian Empire. Russian Empire was bigger than contemporary Russia, but it's mostly the same for now. They are afraid of Russian, and they see us like other. They not understand Russian culture, Russian policy. Some people understand, some people love it, but like I told before, the problem of Brussels bureaucracy that depends of Euro-Atlantic pseudo-values. And of course, they see Russia like treat. But if we can cooperate in normal way and to respect each other, to trust to each other, it will be prosperity for Europe, because cheap gas, cheap oil, and other resources, and very huge Russian market.
Do you see the United States had a plan to separate Europe and Russia?
Of course, it's a very old idea to separate main European powers like Germany, like France, from Russia. It's an idea based on some works of American scientists from late 19th century to separate China, Russia, and Germany. For example, it's the idea of Helford Mackinder, idea of Spikeman, other geopolitical scientists. And till now, they have a project of decolonize Russia, and I mean it's separate Russia part by part. And,
split Russia up.
Yes, and just to fight with Russia till its end. Of course, we cannot to accept this idea.
And is Europe right to be wary of China, or should they see China as an opportunity for mutual benefit?
I read many books of European authors for last decades, and they are total anti-Chinese propaganda. They are afraid of Chinese techniques, about Chinese productions, and they propose idea to develop European goods, but it's not work. So there is question, why Europe cannot do it? Why they depends on Chinese goods? It's question to Europe. Another factor is European historical racism, xenophobia, because China's civilization is different. The type of Mongoloid type, if we speak about classical anthropology, and Russian seems more like Europeans, but Chinese no. Chinese have a totally other type of culture. They have totally logic. Actually, they have not logic in a European sense, in sense of Aristotle, because they think in other way, very specific.
And how important is it that states embrace, because I know you've written about this, how important is it that states embrace religion and tradition rather than the liberalism which is so pervasive in the West?
If we see like liberalism works in progress, it's going to extermination of human being itself. And religion, it means that connection.
Why do you say that? Why do you say it?
Because it started from liberation of church, of human history, of customs, church, tradition, religious, then traditional values, then statehood, because an ultimate goal, there should be no state. It should be one world by liberal ideology, globalist. And of course, they need no traditional customs and need no religions, different types of beliefs. But without belief, human being cannot exist. You see that majority of the world follow any kind of traditions, different type of tradition, Abrahamic traditions like Christian, Muslim, for Judaism, and Buddhism, or even paganism tradition in different corner of the world. So it for millenniums, and why we should accept idea to be without belief, be without religion, if it worked for many, many ages ago. Support people, and people need it. And there is no any contradiction between kind of technical development and beliefs. And we can too go to the external space and also believe in God. But I see no problems. So it's a problem of liberalism itself.
And you are starting to see in Europe and indeed in America kind of coming back of tradition, patriotism, in part Christianity. Do you think that's essential for Europe to get rid of this ideology of liberalism and start having more of traditional values and patriotism? Is that the only way that Europe can save itself?
It's more easy to destroy than construct. So for Europe, we need to reorganize education, to reorganize state system, to reorganize Ministry of Culture, etc., etc. It's a long way. So it was a very big mistake with multiculturalism, first of all, and also historical mistake with Enlightenment, because they started to produce some very destructive ideas and that supported in other regions and other corners. Of course, it's part of history, it's part of European philosophy, but it should be reversed, I think.
And when do you think the special military operation in Ukraine will end, and what will the world look like when it does?
When the West will stop support of Ukraine, at least technically, military, it will be finished very quickly. And of course, Russian the leadership has very clear goal to combat neo-Nazism in Ukraine, to combat Ukrainian militarism, and to provide assistance and support to Russian people there, because they are oppressed by contemporary neo-Nazi regime, and not in only eastern, southern regions of Ukraine, but also in the central parts, in the west, because Russian Orthodox Church is prohibited, the other political parties prohibited, that only need to support neo-Nazi regime of Zelensky. So it's a kind of new dictatorship that should be destroyed. It's kind of a new Nazism, and that also should be destroyed. It's also threat to European countries, because we see a contraband of weapons from Ukraine to different markets through Europe, of course. To also recently it was a scandal in Romanian border, and there was some weapon planet to be go to Israel, and so it's also threat to many countries, not only for Europe.
And why do you think at the moment Trump is trying to push peace in Ukraine, a new deal, and it's the Europeans who are stopping it? How can you explain that Trump is I think genuinely trying to create peace in Ukraine, but it's the Europeans who are stopping it, and when it's European industry that's being damaged, European lives that are being lost. How do you explain that, the difference, the dichotomy of America is trying to create peace in Europe, but it's the Europeans that are blocking it?
I think Trump not understand how politics works. He's a businessman, and he personally thinks that maybe the United States will get some benefit from this conflict. Then he tried to understand what Russia means, doing this special military operation, and how to stop it, and Putin provide him very clear agenda, why we do it, what should be done, and how we can to stop sanction, how we can to cooperate again with the United States, etc. Maybe Trump think positively in this way, but he more theorist. Also, around him is a lot of hawks. A lot of neoconservatives who would like to continue this war because they have a personal business interest to provide weapons to Ukraine. And there is the problem. But of course, Russia understands very well what happens, understand interest of European countries, Brussels bureaucracy, understand the position of United States, and we will continue this operation when our goals will be finished.
But why do you think Europe is blocking it, then?
Europe?
Yeah.
I think there's a kind of a Russophobic agenda, mostly, that in European political elites for the moment. Of course, there's a kind of old, good, skilled diplomats understand that the conflict should be stopped, and the problem mostly from Ukraine. I mean, also terroristic acts on Nord Stream pipelines and also other activity of Ukrainian terrorists inside of European countries, what they're doing now in Poland, in Germany, in Italy, etc. The problem for political elites in Ukraine and in European countries.
And finally, are you confident about Russia's future?
I see that Russia's future will be in prosperity, because Russia is, in sense of geopolitics, if autonomous country and autonomous space. We have huge resources. We have autarky. We not depend, a little bit depends of some Western goods, but less and less from year to year. And in this sense, it's good that we started special military operation, and we reorganizing our economic system. We are more close to global East, to global source, and it's also about multipolarity, because more southern and eastern powers cooperate with Russia, we cooperate with them, and we less depends on the collective West.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Good night to all of our listeners. You are tuning to Iran Radio, broadcast from Tehran. Today is Wednesday, and here are some interesting facts about Islam. During the Middle Ages, the Muslim world had two numerous business advantages. They had a huge range of contacts, so they could trade everything from African gold to Chinese porcelain to European amber and furs. And Muslim craft workers were highly skilled, which meant their goods always found a real market. Without Muslim merchants, Europeans would have had no rice, sugar, or coffee. Approximately 5 to 8 million Muslims lived in the United States, and there are over 1,200 mosques. Muslims have been a part of the cultural landscape in America for the past 200 years. The Islamic Empire once stretched into modern-day Europe, particularly in Spain and the Balkans. Today, there are tens of millions of Muslims living in Europe. Now we'll listen to the continuation of our schedule on Iran Radio. We'll start off this hour's programs with the Spotlight, a daily program which covers the most important events happening in the world today. After that, we have Let's Recite the Quran. The program teaches eloquent recitation of the Holy Quran at level 2. A to Z of Life will be our final program this hour. The program presents an Islamic-Iranian lifestyle in a variety of ways, making use of the ayahs of the Holy Quran, as well as inspirational poetry and stories. Stay with us.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor.
The Spotlight.
and welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. Pressure from the outside and imploding from within seems the best way to describe what is happening to the Israeli regime. From growing international pressure by the global civic community to internal political turmoil and a military which has not been able to destroy the resistance but has killed many civilians. That's the reality inside of the Zionist entity. As the military is exhausted and suicide is increasing amongst IOF troops who took a major hit from the Palestinian resistance like the regime had never experienced before. Are we looking at the beginning of the end to the Zionist regime? Well, let's start with the following report.
On the battlefield, the tone has been staggering. Since the start of the Gaza war in early October of 2023, 22,000 wounded soldiers have been treated, with some 58% of them suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, or other mental health conditions. Nearly two-thirds are reservists, many of whom have been called back for repeated tours. Mental health workers reporting record levels of trauma, burnout, and even rising suicide rates.
I think we're going to have a massive wave of suicides that we're not ready to deal with. This is the part that does keep me up at night in a way, because I have no way of knowing if any of my friends are going down that path.
The pressure is also exploding on the home front. A draft bill to conscript more ultra-Orthodox or Haredi men into the army has triggered massive protests and created what analysts describe as one of Israel's biggest internal crises in decades. Only around 1,200 Haredi men reported for service last year, despite 24,000 draft notices. And now new reporting underscores widening cracks between Netanyahu and military leadership. According to Hebrew media, a stormy cabinet meeting saw Netanyahu clash directly with IOF Chief of Staff Eyal Zamir over a proposal to displace Gazans to the south and impose a siege on the north. Zamir pushed back sharply, saying,
"There is no stalemate in the strip. We're doing exactly what you tasked us with, and you don't need to be reminded that we have soldiers dying in battle."
Netanyahu then reportedly demanded the IOF draw up a massive civilian evacuation plan, prompting Zamir to ask,
"Do you want a military government? Who will govern 2 million people?"
Zamir warned the proposal could lead to loss of control over hungry, displaced civilians. Netanyahu is also said to be considering firing War Minister Israel Katz amid disputes over internal military investigation and command authority. Katz and Zamir have openly criticized each other in recent days, prompting Netanyahu to hold separate meetings to contain the turmoil. Israel's aggressions in the region have left tens of thousands of soldiers wounded, with PTSD and suicide risks surging among reservists. On the home turf, attempts to draft more Haredi men have ignited mass protests, deepening societal divides. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Netanyahu faces escalating clashes with military leaders and infighting among top ministers, exposing fractures at the highest levels of power, with political turmoil, military strain, and social unrest piling up as a repercussions of the two-year genocidal war on